This is Paul Puckett, and welcome back to Getting There, the money show that focuses on your life. Hope you all had a great week. As I predicted last week, the world has not yet ended. Of course, I was referring to the coming election, and it still won't end as a result of anybody that we vote for, despite what we read in the news. I ended the show last week with a conversation, which I'll repeat now, with an investor who asked how investment advisors charge their fees. And, of course, most of us charge a percentage of assets under management, meaning the money we manage for someone. We assess an annual fee, generally taken quarterly or monthly. And it's not necessarily a percentage. I think the average for million-dollar accounts is probably around 1%. Smaller accounts, and when I say smaller, they're not small, 250,000, half a million, a lot of advisors probably average 1.25 to 1.5. You'll be happy to know that yours truly, because we do not have office space, you don't have to pay for our office space, and so we're substantially lower. You know, I probably should start now, since I'm talking about how investment advisors charge, with the disclosure. I'm Paul Puckett. I'm an investment advisor with Q1 Advisors, serving clients in Virginia and Florida. More information on Q1 Advisors at www.q1advisors.com. I'm also an independent insurance agent serving clients in Florida and Virginia. And you can find out more about me at www.ppuckett.com, ppuckett.com. I'm sure the regulators are happy that I've gotten that disclosure out of the way. I know I am. I would add that everything I say on this show is intended to be general in nature, because I'm not sitting across from you and don't have access to your personal portfolio or know you enough to make any recommendations specifically for you. So they're general. You need to check into them before you implement any of them in your portfolio by either giving me a call or talking to your current professional or going online to Dr. Google, who you may or may not rely on for financial advice. Lots of good websites out there. Morningstar.com I like. Plenty of places to go. Okay. So how do investment advisors typically charge fees? Well, for the average investor, whether it's Vanguard, Fidelity, an independent registered investment advisor like Q1 Advisors, Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley in their advisor division, what you're probably going to see is a percentage fee of the assets under management. Well, I was chatting at the coffee shop with a fellow, and I finished the show last week just hinting at what I was talking about. What he said was, why do you guys have to take money from a portfolio all the time? You know, why can't you just get paid when you actually grow the portfolio, as in percentage fees? And the way a percentage fee works is, let's say that actually it doesn't really matter how much you have in the account, except from a regulatory standpoint, which we'll come up with in just a minute. We're not going to come up with it. We're going to discuss it in just a minute. The way you charge a performance fee, and the average industry performance fee is 20%. So let's just say that your profit over a given time period is 10 grand. Well, the advisor would take 2,000, that's 20% of the 10 grand, as their fee. The problem is there aren't any advisors who charge, that I'm aware of, who only charge performance fees. They're an add-on. And this particular configuration in the industry, we call it the 220, the 220. For some of those of you I see at blues concerts, not a 420, that's a different meaning. This is a 220. 220 means 2% asset management fee plus 20% of profits. I went to a conference in New York City about, probably about 15 years ago to learn more about this particular investment used by Harvard, Yale, and lots of other investors out there. And so today we're going to spend a few minutes talking about hedge funds. Hedge funds. Now I'm going to play a song that is going to introduce this segment on hedge funds. It won't make any sense until you hear the story, but then I'd be warning you in advance. So let's just go straight to the song. Oh. Did you suddenly have an urge to go horseback riding out west? Maybe you wanted to be a city slicker. That was the theme song from the movie City Slickers, as you may recall, starring Billy Crystal. My favorite scene from the movie being an espresso lover, as you might know already, is the battery-powered electric coffee grinder, which caused the stampede, which, of course, put Billy Crystal's character in the doghouse with Curly. I think his name was Curly. You know, one day we'll have to do a show about the one thing. That was what was really cool about that movie. It was entertaining, but it had a message. So why Why did I choose that to open, given there wasn't exactly a preponderance of electric guitars? Because the investment that people buy with performance-based fees is almost always a hedge fund. And, of course, Billy Crystal's character, and Billy Crystal himself, I think, live in New York, where most hedge funds, okay, well, that may not be true, but where a lot of hedge funds are located. So what exactly is a hedge fund? Good question. In basic terms, generally speaking, they're structured as a limited partnership, and a hedge fund, you are buying the skills of a manager who has a goal of something that performs differently than the market. It's an alternative investment. A hedge fund isn't available to everyone. That's why I'm keeping the definition basic, because most of you, you know, you're not going to buy one anyway, and I'm going to be telling the rest of you, you probably shouldn't, but that's coming up. You must be an accredited investor to buy a hedge fund. Now, the Securities and Exchange Commission defined what I'm talking about, the term accredited investor. If you are ever approached by a broker who wants to sell you a hedge fund or an advisor who wants to place your money into one, they will be making sure that you are an accredited investor. No, you do not have to take a test to demonstrate that you're an accredited investor, but you will have to give some financial information. The Securities and Exchange Commission defines an accredited investor as one who has at least the following characteristics. You earn an individual income, can include your spouse, of at least $200,000 per year. Don't you love it when you're looking at the SEC website while you're on the radio and they start playing music? So you make at least $200,000 per year, or you and your spouse together make at least $300,000, and this must be at least over the past 2 years, and you must be reasonably expected to maintain that level of income. You must have a net worth exceeding $1 million. That can be individual or joint, or you can be a general partner, executive officer, director, or any combination of the actual hedge fund. So chances are you know how this works if you're a general partner, executive officer, director, or a combination of those. Now, why does it matter when you invest your money in a hedge fund whether you're accredited or not? Well, because if you're an accredited investor, you're considered by the regulators to be fully functional without the restrictions and protections the SEC otherwise would have in place. In other words, to invest in one of these performance-based fee vehicles, i.e. a hedge fund, you have to be wealthy enough to handle losing the money without protection. Well, there's some, but without the general protections afforded to investors through the SEC. Doesn't that make you feel good? Well, I still haven't answered the question of why did I pick City Slickers. I said, well, lots of hedge funds are in New York, so why not? Well, I picked a Western movie theme. You'll be hearing some more Western movie music, not movie. You'll be hearing some more Western music coming up here shortly. Because I decided, 15, 16 years ago, that I should go to a conference. I mentioned that, but I didn't say how the conference started. So I could learn more about the investments that Harvard and Yale and everybody were using. And the first speaker of the conference took the stage, and he took an odd position. He had a headset mic on, so there was no stand. And he was not only the first speaker, he was the president of the association that was holding the conference, and he was opening the conference, introducing every speaker as well as speaking himself. So he was welcoming us all to this conference, and he took an odd body position. He walked up, waved at everybody as the audience noise started coming down in recognition that he was about to speak. He put his feet fairly far apart and he put his hands far out to his sides, sort of paused, think good, bad, and the ugly. And then suddenly, with no warning, he pretended to draw 2 6 guns and shoot them in the air, and he said, "Welcome to the New York Hedge Fund Conference, the Wild West of Investing." So I wanted to make the point that this is not for everybody. In my opinion, it may not be for anybody, because what do hedge fund managers do to achieve the 20% profit, 20% fee on the profits they make? Not necessarily 20% profit. And what's the record? What is the record for hedge funds? And what problems might there be when you go to a database to find out what the record is? Let's say you're me and one of my clients insists, "Paul, I want to put 20% of my money in hedge funds. I want to be like these pension funds, and I want to be like these college endowments. I have the money. I would like to take advantage of that by buying these vehicles that I hear so much about. They must be really good." Well, sorry, I got to throw in another jargon term. Accredited investor, just told you, you got to have $1 million in net worth plus $200,000 of individual income or $300,000 of joint, and the reasonable expectation of continuing to make that. When you go to look at hedge funds, you're going to discover something. They all seem to do well, which may strike you because you probably have seen headlines, there's one in the news right now, of big hedge funds collapsing. So if you would think, if you take the average performance of a group of funds and some of them blow up and fail, that would bring the average return down, right? Nope. Sorry. Survivorship bias. Now, this goes beyond hedge funds. I'll take it up another show. But here's what survivorship bias means. Take 100 hedge funds a decade ago. And all 100 hedge funds are around today. That's not a factual statement. This is an example. Take 100 hedge funds, every single one of them, whether they do well or poorly, is still here today. And so you take an average performance of the 100 hedge funds over the decade, and you have what a hedge fund might average over this 10-year period. But what if 90 survive and 10 explode in such a way that investors lose some or all of their money? Well, when did they explode? The day after 10 years? Well, that's fine. Then we still have their numbers. But what if some of them lost all their money the first year, some did in the fifth year, seventh, ninth? Well, when you look today at the 100 hedge funds that started 10 years ago, using an example, there are many more than that, you don't know when you don't see 100, you see 73, that 27 of them went bye-bye. All numbers used in this section of the broadcast are made up. It's to make a point. You don't know that. And the databases don't exactly provide it to you. So survivorship bias is average returns of only the surviving funds. Think about that. That means every fund that lost money isn't included when you see an article saying the average return of hedge funds over the past decade is blank. The ones that failed aren't in there. They fail all the time. Well, not all the time, but often, particularly when compared to other funds. I mean, look at the fund like Vanguard Wellington. How many decades has that fund been around? A long, 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 long time. There are hedge funds that have been around for a while, not as long as Vanguard Wellington, but they tend to occasionally fail. Why? Because they take huge risk with your money. The Wild West of Investing. That makes me think maybe we should hear another song.
Good as gold, bonanza, hand in hand we built this land, the Ponderosa Ranch. Our birthright is this Cartwright bonanza. We here for long and standing strong. Wrong ain't got a chance. Day by day, worker played, ready side by side. Hello, friend, come on in. The gate is open wide. Bound to be a fighting free bonanza. Singing pines are boundary lines for the Ponderosa Ranch. Side by side, hello friend, come on in. It is open wide,
bound to be a fighting free bonanza. Singing pines and boundary lines for the Ponderosa Ranch.
One of the great TV shows, baby boomers will remember, those Michael Landon fans out there will remember, ladies, I personally preferred Hoss, will remember the TV show Bonanza. That was the theme from Bonanza, but not the one you heard on the air. That, as I'm sure you know, was Johnny Cash singing Bonanza. Great show about the West. Now, I would think the Cartwright family might have been more like regulators than hedge fund managers. They tended to enforce the laws and protect the people. They tended to be on the good side. I'm not a big fan of hedge funds, you can probably tell. And the reason is, I just don't have faith in putting someone's money into an investment vehicle that has very few restrictions and where what you're really buying, at the end of the day, is the hedge fund manager's skill. Is the hedge fund manager's skill. And maybe they have awesome skills, but how long? And will they have the sense to say, okay, we've doubled the fund, let's close the doors before we do something stupid? Not many managers have the sense to do that. And in their defense, hey, after you've been winning for a while, why would you assume you're going to lose? I mean, seriously. So when you think, if only my investment advisor charged me a performance-based fee, I would be so much better off. Just recognize that the investment advisors who charge performance-based fees in general are high-risk managers, and they have to be because they want that 20% fee, and they only get it if they win, and the bigger they win, the bigger the fee. Therefore, let's roll the dice, baby. All right, let's take a brief break, and we'll be coming up on some other topics, but maybe instead of a break, hey, one last Western theme song. This one a bit more guitar-oriented.
Oh, mama, I'm in fear for my life from the long arm of the law. Lawman is putting end to my running, and I'm so far from my home. Oh, mama, I can hear you a-crying, you're so scared and all alone. Hangman is coming down from the gallows, and I don't have very long.
Tea is up, the news is out, they finally found me. Renegade.
I've played that group before. You've heard them on the show, Styx. And that was Renegade. Offense intended. Oh, I'm sorry. No offense intended. If you're a hedge fund listening to the show, hedge fund manager listening to the show, I doubt hedge funds are listening to anything since they don't have ears at any rate. Welcome back. You know, I had a question asked to me this week about the impact that computers have on investing. Now, we could take a very sophisticated approach to that, and maybe we will, not this show, because I'd rather talk about the computer's impact on investing from a behavioral standpoint. How does a computer, or how did a computer, because they've been around for a while, affect how individual investors handle their money? It also affects how Wall Street handles money as well. Some things are possible today due to computers that could never have been done back in the day before the personal computer or PC or the MacBook. So, after an actual break, we will dive into how computers affect investing. When we get back. Hi, this is Paul Puckett. As you may know, I love coffee. My friends would tell you I don't love coffee. It's an obsession, and not just any coffee. Espresso. If you're in the Bradenton area, one of the jewels of Bradenton is Old Main Street, and you'll find a coffee shop, B-Town Coffee, with a great alley and awnings and fans to keep you cool in the summer and in the shade, free Wi-Fi, and quite frankly, the best hot dog in town. Stop by. You'll enjoy B-Town Coffee. Incidentally, the music played on the show, like what you just heard, is, believe it or not, it's now that's played by real musicians, but I have no clue the name of the band. It's Beyond the Delta, available as a stinger, 10 seconds, 30 seconds, and 2.5 minutes, that I specifically purchased so that I can play them every week on the radio in between topics of the show, as opposed to the songs I play, which are currently operating under a Creative Commons license through YouTube. Now you're thinking YouTube is not radio. True. But these are downloaded from YouTube under the Creative Commons license because this is currently not a commercial show. It may seem like one occasionally because we attempt to sound professional. We being, that would be me. It always did worry me when, you know, you're evaluating firms on a side note and you see, say, four people in their, say, late 20s, early 30s, and it says over 50 years of combined experience. Or we, when it's a solo operation. It can't be helped. I don't want to judge too harshly. I'm guilty of it myself on occasion. But it does tend to make you wonder, why don't you just say I? Or are you trying to imply you're bigger than you are? Ooh, I wanted to cover that today too. But let's get back to the impact of computers on investing. Well, from an individual investing standpoint, the computer both helped and in some ways hurt individual investors. So let's start with how it helps. Computers make it possible with the spreadsheets and the websites and the performance analysis programs that let you know how your portfolio is doing, if you're so inclined to load it into that type of software on your own, let you know how you did. You can decide, is my strategy working? Now, I'm making some assumptions here, and I don't know the statistics, but the assumption I'm making, I would bet, does not apply to the majority of individual investors. It does apply to some, though. For instance, there's a group called the Bogleheads. They follow John Bogle, who was the founder, still living, of Vanguard Funds, and is very prolific in his writing and in his opinions on money management and how people should manage their money. I'm not in total agreement with Mr. Bogle, but I'm more agreement than not. My disagreement with those guys these days is they still think bond funds are a good idea, and they will be until they're not. Sorry, it's just the way it's going to work. So, well, what do they do and investors like them that makes me say a computer is very helpful for them and it didn't get in the way of their returns or it didn't affect their life that much in a negative way? Well, here's what they do. Asset allocation, since that came out sort of a blur. They choose a strategy before they invest or as they invest their money, if they're investing monthly, or putting in a lump sum, rollover from their 401k or whatever, they choose to be, for instance, 50% or 60% Vanguard Total Stock Market, 30 to 40% Vanguard Total Bond Market, the remainder in cash. And they might include, one of Vanguard's Total Market funds includes an international exposure, so maybe they use some international as well. Whatever it is, you can be more sophisticated than that. You could pick 10 or 12 funds. Here's what a computer does. It allows you to trade those securities, to buy them in your portfolio through either Vanguard directly, Fidelity directly, the mutual fund company directly, or if you're using a variety of funds, maybe combined with some exchange-traded funds, through TD Ameritrade, who I use, or Schwab, or Fidelity's brokerage platform. Vanguard has a brokerage platform now. There's plenty of them out there. And I'm talking about discount brokerage firms. Now, if your account is with a major brokerage firm like an Edward Jones, Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley, you can log into your account with a computer. And of course, you couldn't do that before computers. They neither provided the data nor could you access it, but computers made that possible. So computers in many ways help you as an investor to know what your portfolio is doing and to analyze what you're investing in. Those are good things when used properly. Now, you'll remember a few weeks ago, I talked about the concept of total return, which is the combination of gains and losses plus the income you receive on that investment. Obviously, if the fees are not part of the investment, then net of fees. You got to subtract at the end so you can see what your total return was. And I said, well, maybe we should think, and this show is about thinking, about the whole return, W-H-O-L-E, whole return. Well, what would that be? And if you didn't hear that show, I'm going to just briefly cover it now, and you can go to the website, www.gettingthere.com, to understand more about whole investing. What I said is, let's say two investors, both get, we'll just say, a 10% return in a given time period, let's say a year. And one of them spent a couple hours every quarter, maybe a few more on the annual review, just making sure that he was or she was implementing the strategy they chose, keeping an eye on things, but not getting carried away. Well, computers really help you do that, and that would be, in this case, that 10% return was generated in 8 to 12 hours over a given year. Now, there's countless hours on the mutual fund manager's part, the exchange-traded manager's fund part, the professionals, but I'm talking about the investor here. The other investor also got 10%. And this introduces the downside of computers when it comes to individual investors and their portfolios. The other investor is fascinated by the data available on a computer. As a matter of fact, so fascinated that they spend most of their day analyzing the markets and specific securities they've selected or chosen to buy or sell. And they analyze those securities and they analyze market movements. Now, technical investing was around before computers. It was just harder to do. Technical investors don't really look at company names. They look at performance of individual stocks, generally speaking, or bonds, whatever they're investing in. And they look for signals based on how the market is moving. For instance, the 200-day moving average. And when it hits certain points, they feel that's an indication to buy. And when it hits other points, they feel that's an indication to sell. And professional managers do this as well, by the way. They don't actually look at the fundamentals of a company, and they're not looking at their overall portfolio from a strategy standpoint. They're spending a huge amount of time, if they're individual investors, using their computer to analyze all sorts of things in the market. Now, keep in mind, at the end of this given hypothetical year, this person who spent, say, 1,000 hours or more, I'm not kidding, over the course of the year, on their computer, on their phone, on multiple computers. I actually met an investor like this who had 8 monitors hooked up to 2 computers so that during the trading day, it was actually worse than the bridge of the Starship Enterprise. You know, think of a bar with football games, baseball games, golf, and all sorts of things happening on multiple TV screens, and now let's change that to 8 TV screens, and these were fairly big, and about 30 inches each. I know that's not big by today's standards, but at any rate, when they're all combined, they are, on just what's happening in the market. Red and green flashing on one, a graph popping up on the other. It was just absolutely nuts. He enjoyed it. Well, let's say he also gets a 10% return. Well, they both got the same return. But one investor only spent about 12 hours a year, the other one over 1,000. So when you factor in time, which is worth infinitely more than money, the whole return was much higher, don't you agree, for the investor who managed to get it all done in just a few hours. So the downside, and there is one, the downside of computers that has affected individuals and how they manage their money is very simply data overload. It gives people the opportunity to think, now I can beat the market. Look at all this data I have. Keeping in mind that Wall Street has always had more data than, no offense, you will. They just do, unless you feel like spending $1,500 a month for, or whatever it is these days, for a Bloomberg terminal or something comparable. You're never going to have institutional level software in your house. But my point would be you don't need it, that your whole return is going to be higher if you structure a plan in advance, stick to the plan, and invest for the long term, not worrying about, for instance, elections, natural disasters like hurricanes, bad news, market falls. Long-term investors, I'm telling you, I know quite a few of them, even some who do it all by themselves, don't get worried about that. They don't see it as a buy or a sell signal because they're investing for what? The long term. Now, on this show, how do we define long term? I used to always say 10 years, and maybe just to be to make the point stronger, or possibly because we finally had a decade of the S&P 500 that wasn't exactly what one would call positive, 15 years. 15 years. Now, let's take a brief break and talk about individual investors who are approaching retirement or in retirement and a 15-year investment, long-term type investment. Does that make any sense at all? The short answer to that question, does that make any sense at all for someone who's approaching retirement and particularly someone who is in retirement to have a portion of their money in long-term investments, if we define long-term as 12 to 15 years? Does that make any sense? Yes, one of the biggest mistakes individual investors make, and hey, in your defense, if you're one of them, how could you not make the mistake? You get hammered on by the media and by many in my profession. Oh boy, you're approaching retirement. You need to get out of the stock market. Huh. Well, a little fact that might surprise you. Way back in 1933, if I recall, when Social Security was created, about 1% of people in the United States lived beyond the age of 65. See, Social Security was created to provide funds for those of advanced years who made it to 66 or more. And now, even back then, I mean, some of my ancestors made it to 90 and 100. I'm sure some of yours did too. But on average, lifespans were not as long back in 1933. So if you said to me, Paul, the average man lives 66 years, the average woman 68 years, should they be invested in the stock market when they're 65? The answer is probably not, but it depends. If they have adequate income and they want to provide a legacy to their children or grandchildren or both, or to a charity of their choosing, then yes, they should stay in the markets because that's where the growth is. But only if they have enough income and can afford the risk when they're not working. Now, let's flip it, please, to modern times, where the Insurance Association would tell you the average male is getting up into the mid-80s, average, and the average female, almost 90. So 65 is not that big a deal anymore. And I realize your kids may say, wow, you're getting old when you're 65. I don't think they say that much anymore. I live in a community, it's not a retirement community, but there are a lot of people here for the golf and the weather, particularly in the winter from Canada or wherever, who are above 65 years of age. I'd challenge some of you in your 20s to go out and try to beat some of those guys at golf or the ladies. 65 is not old. Matter of fact, just for fun, my definition of old. When you reach an age where you cannot think of or name anyone who is 10 years older than you, you're just getting on the edge of old. You're just getting on the edge of old. If you're very lucky, you have a friend that makes to 100, and by my definition, that would mean at 90, you're not old yet. Hey, it's not all about chronological age anymore. We have, what was the $6 million man, Steve Austin? We have the technology. Or, more importantly, through the computers, we know more about holistic living and vitamins and eating healthy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So computers are just a tool. They're just a tool. But on the individual investor side, they're a tool that can either make your life easier using websites like mint.com to track all of your assets on one site, or simply using them to log into wherever you have accounts, doing some research that you need to do quarterly, maybe, occasionally. Let's avoid any addictions to trying to figure out exactly what the market's going to do. Then they're beneficial. But a computer can also be used as a tool that takes you down a very dark road, the road to ruin, the road to losses, the road to thinking, hey, I can margin my account. That means borrow money. I can margin my account, beat the market, and become incredibly wealthy, day trading. Speaking of survivorship bias, there are plenty of courses available for those of you who wish to learn day trading from the few who successfully have done it. If you're at a cocktail party and someone says to you, oh, I day trade all the time. I don't know why Paul would say that. I do phenomenally well. They very well may be telling the truth. They really might, but I don't think you should do anything other than say, hey, I was heading over to the bar to get a drink. Would you like one? And don't listen to what they're buying or selling because you don't know when they bought or sold it. And what are you doing listening to people? I mean, is that really a right way to invest? People do it all the time. They did it before computers that way, and they still do. Let's have a little fun with another semi-Western song. Okay, I found it when I was looking up Western songs, but technically it's not. And this particular song is what the day trader and the hedge fund manager both think they can do. Straits, Money for Nothing. You know, if I thought I could get away with it, okay, that's not really an accurate statement. Because, first of all, you can't get money for nothing. I'm sorry. I wish you could. I was just thinking Money for Nothing Asset Management would be a great name for a firm, assuming they could actually do it. But whether you're an individual investor or a hedge fund manager, there ain't no such thing as money for nothing. Incidentally, for those of you who are music lovers like I am, occasionally hearing a song you've heard 100 times with an equalizer scrolling by in front of you is just a really cool experience because you see a graphic illustration of what your ears already know. So thank you again for joining Getting There. We're going to continue the conversation next week looking at more about how computers affect investing at the Wall Street level and the individual level, and also looking at, when you hire someone like me, or when you go with a broker, or you go with a big firm, or you go with a bank, trust department, or private banking department, what's the money you're paying for? You know, the good question that I may ask again, I believe I asked in one of the earlier shows, is it's also important to look at your overall portfolio and ask yourself, hey, what's the money for? What do I want to use it for? What's its purpose? Well, that's also a good thing to ask about how you pick and choose an advisor and how you pay them. Hope you listen closely to why I don't recommend hedge funds. Just saying, it's the Wild West. Y'all enjoy your week. I will look forward to talking with you again on Getting There next week.